You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend. And Tracy, it's Saturday. It's Pathfinder Day. It's recording day. Baby Yoda slash Grogu has been head bopping to the music. And we are sitting here with a guest, and you are ridiculously excited about.
I am ridiculously excited. I know I say this a lot, but this is the side effect of I get to choose who gets booked. And so, yes. Like, I play to my own interests here. It's an entirely selfish endeavor. But I think it's a selfish endeavor that yields good results. So I'm ridiculously stoked to have Lewis Sacker on. And if that's a name that feels sort of vaguely familiar to you in a kind of like, wait, no, I've been here before. Isn't that Holes? Isn't that Sideways Stories from Wayside School? Isn't that the Moss book? Like, wait, I think I've heard that before. Yes, you've heard that before. But this is the first time you would have heard Lewis Sacker with an adult novel. So this is the Magician of Tiger Castle that brings him here today. So Lewis, welcome aboard and congratulations on tackling something very new.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be here and I'm delighted that the Magician of Tiger Castle is out now.
Yeah. Okay. So one of the things that got me excited to talk to you, other than, you know, I've been reading things of yours since I was an elementary school student myself, is the fact that one of our podcast favorites, who we've had on a couple of times before, Alex Harrow, happened to have blurbed The Magician of Tiger Castle. And there was something to her blurb that just like got me right in the heart here. It runs as thus. After decades of children's stories with adult intelligence, Sacker has given us an adult novel with a child's heart. And I think that spoke to me in a particularly poignant way because I feel that we are living in a world where we need more things probably with a child's heart to them. And so I would love to hear about what brought you to the decision to write this book.
Okay. I should say that when I saw that quote, I just thought, that's perfect. That's not exactly what I was trying to do.
Yeah.
Well, I actually started it as a young adult book. It was going to be a story about Pedo and Princess Tulia, set in the 16th century, and Tulia's got an arranged marriage with a prince, but she falls in love with the lowly Pedo, who, as a result, is subsequently thrown in the dungeon and sentenced to be executed.
Jan, jan, jan.
And my story was going to be about them. You know, they're 16, 17 years old, so it was going to be a young adult story. And I chose as my narrator this quirky magician type. He calls himself a magician, but in the 16th century, there really was no difference between magic and science and religion, for that matter. Mm-hmm. And he was just going to be my quirky narrator. And as I wrote the story, he just became... Well, he just took over.
Don't you love it when that happens, though?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I always just have vague ideas about what my books are going to be when I start. I don't have an outline. I don't know exactly where I'm going.
Oh, see, you and I just became best friends.
Good.
Seriously, now, I am a seat of the pants writer. I always have been.
And as a result, I end up doing 7 or 8 drafts because the first draft's all over the place.
Sure.
And, you know, so the first, I don't know, 3 drafts are just figuring out the characters and the story, and then subsequent drafts are trying to just, you know, work on the telling it as artistically as I can. And so I was about maybe a third of the way through the third draft when I realized that this was a story about Anatole. It was no longer just about Pedo and Tulia. And Anatole is 40-something. And that something is a little important at the end. But but Anatole, you know, you can't have a 40-year-old as a main character of a children's book. So I decided I'll turn it into a children's book. And which is, you know, one of the reasons I set this in the 16th century is I don't really relate that well to modern day kids anymore. I wrote the Wayside School Stories back when I was 22 years old is when I started those. Mm-hmm. I'm now in my early 70s. So I don't really feel all that comfortable writing for kids anymore. I felt very comfortable writing for people like you, people who grew up reading my books.
Sure.
You know, it's just the same old audience.
Right. And, we've just finally caught up to where you were ready to be. So,
Well, the language of kids anymore, it's changed so much. Like I go over to my friend's house to play Pathfinder, and he has a daughter. Oh God, like 11 or 12, going on 30, and I don't understand half the things she says. Like I'm just lost.
Yeah,
no clue.
Well, I've never tried to keep up with modern slang.
Yeah, that's.
A good rule. If you read the Wayside School books, they have their own kind of enthusiastic way of talking.
Sure.
But they're not trying to use modern words.
Well, the childhood comes out in how they relate to their situation, not so much in like, because of course any slang, it gets dated and it gets sort of garbled over time.
Dude, no way.
Right, and you sound
gnarly,
and you can sound ridiculous using it.
Right, yeah.
So that wasn't so much the issue as just understanding kids always on their phones, always, you know, without being critical of that. Even though when I see it, I think, what a waste. I just getting inside their heads now is just harder for me.
Yeah. But you're already inside Tracy's head, so it's just easier to write a book for her today.
There we go.
Right.
Yeah.
same kind of fun that those books, those early books had.
Yeah.
And to the point that you're making about, you know, if Anatole is going to be kind of our narrator and our perspective character here as someone in his 40s, his particular connection to Tullia and her dilemma of being in love with someone, but there's this arranged marriage, and he's being strong-armed by the king to assist in making the arranged marriage come off by way of his particular gifts, his air quote magics, to make her compliant. But that he has a relationship to Tullia where everybody has been seen him as something of a joke. But to Tullia, he's someone who matters. He has a relationship with her where they have a camaraderie and a kind of faith in one another, and to be asked to violate that faith. It's a really interesting, I think, thing to interrogate. Like what is the relationship of an adult to a child who isn't their child, but who has this feeling of responsibility and kinship with them? And like, how do you negotiate that loyalty against the opportunity to please someone who expects this thing of you and sort of redeem yourself as a failure in their eyes?
Right. That's the dilemma of the story and the fun of the story. I mean, Anatole is no hero. He's, at least to begin with, he's more concerned about saving his career, and he's ready to do something that, you know, in order to do that, he has to betray Tullian to some extent, although he rationalizes it and doesn't see it that way. And then in order to do this, I never make too much of an issue about this in the book.
Sure.
But in order to do it, in order to try to save Tullia, he has to first create this potion, which means he has to experiment with it. And he uses Peto, who's in the dungeon, as the subject of his experiments, which is, you know, in modern day, that's highly unethical, if not criminal.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've never talked about that. And I, you know, my editor asked me to write 10 questions for the like book club,
you sure. know,
that they sometimes do when the paperback comes out. And one of my questions was it ethical for Anatole to experiment on pedo? And if not, why do we still like him and root for him? You know, which I think is a great question.
It is.
So, okay, smarty pants. It's a great question. What in your heart of hearts would you hope the answer to that would be? This is interesting to me because Patrick and I were actually having a conversation before you arrived for the recording about the intentions that a writer has versus what readers might take away. And so, okay, you wrote the question. You have your own vision of Anatole. What would you hope people would read there?
I think they should recognize that it was unethical. It was, on the same token, we like Anatole. His motives are for the most part good. Pedo knows the experiments are going on and agrees to them because Anatole tells them they'll help Tullia, and he's in love with Tullia, so he wants to help her. I'm not sure that's enough to say, yeah, he's doing the right thing, but we understand it and we like him and we like Pedo, we like Tullia. And his basic plan kind of helps him, but will, if it's successful, at least will help them all.
Not
the way they want, though. So I don't know. It's a moral question.
I think it does come back to, there's this funny thing about human nature where if we like someone enough, we might decide to forgive them or tolerate things from them that, and from anyone else, we would see as condemnable, or something that we couldn't redeem. And I think that's books invite us into those sorts of situations. They give us this knowledge of and intimacy with characters and the insides of their heads and their motives, or at the very least make us interested enough in them that we're like, well, I want to stick around and see how this turns out.
Well, I've told the story for years about Kate Elliott. Like, I love Kate Elliott's books. She does a lot of fantasy books. She does all these great things, but Kate Elliott, there's Tad Williams. In Tad Williams' Dragonbone books, the characters were making such horrible decisions that I was getting angry. I was getting so angry. I was shouting at the books. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh my God, why are you making these terrible decisions? And when I told Kate that, she's like, she just grinned. And she's like, yeah. Good. She's like, good. I'm glad that made you angry, because I did the same thing with her books. What were those books? I can see the covers because the covers were like yellow and black. I know Robert's going to know what I'm talking about when he listens to this. But it was a series that she did, in a fantasy series, and people were just making terrible decisions. And I'm like, oh my God, no, don't do that. Why are you making these decisions? And it was just getting me so riled up. And you're grinning right now. Yeah. You're smiling. You're so happy.
Yeah, I mean, that's what a writer's trying to do, is bring out the emotions of the reader. So that's I hadn't read Kate Elliott. I will now.
Yeah. There's something to be said for an author to get under your skin that way.
I remember one of the books in the series is called Prince of Dogs.
Okay.
I cannot remember the rest of the series, but I mean, I can't remember the series name. A Crown of Stars?
That's right. I can just look up Kate Elliott.
Yeah.
The Googles will take care of it. Yeah. I do think, I don't know, as we're talking about how writers get their hooks into us and kind of make us feel for characters, make us think through their actions, make us, you know, gloss over some of the elements of their actions and all of that. There's always this connection between who we are right now and like the circumstances that we're living in and what we're taking away from a book and how we're experiencing it. And so I sort of wonder, you're making this transition to writing something for adults at the same time that our world is, I will gently say, in many transitions. Right. And I think this invites for me the question of, are we at a place now where adults and children, or either or, need different kinds of stories? Is there a kind of story that we need more now, maybe than we, or should realize that we need, that we always needed, and now we just need to pay attention to them more? I don't know.
I can't answer that. I mean, I don't know what people need. It's, for me as a writer, every time I try to, you know, try to think of a new idea, you know, my first thoughts tend to go to, you know, what's going on in the world today and the, you know, fighting fascism. And, but, you know, that's, I feel like the world's cheap. By the time the book's comes out, it's going to either be a lot worse than it is now, or it's going to be,
fingers crossed, not relevant.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't want to get, I also just don't want to spend my time dwelling on that.
Yeah. The book can offer a different kind of space.
Yeah.
I was listening to an interview, and they were talking about what's wrong with Hollywood and why is Hollywood struggling so much to make money? Like, the movies aren't making money. People aren't going to see the movies, you know, that kind of stuff. And one of the ideas that they put forward is, we're living in a grim, dark world right now. Like, the world we live in is very dark, and there's lots of bad things that are happening. And then Hollywood keeps making very dark movies and very dark TV shows. And so there's no escapism. There's nothing to, you know, shine a light.
We need an alternative.
We need the alternative. And that's one reason why they said, like, they thought Superman did so well, was because it was not dark. It was kind of light, and it did have, you know, hope in it and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, with my books, I mean, I don't want to just do escapism. I mean, I don't want to say, let's ignore the world.
But you want hope. You want hope.
And you just want to kind of go back to those. I figure the one thing I can do is go back to those feelings that make us all human, and all, you know, of love and hope and humor.
Very fundamental. Yeah.
Yeah. That's life affirming, and maybe, you know, that's what I can do in my small corner of the world.
And that's why I like Star Trek.
I mean, it does kind of aim in that direction. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, goodness. One of my cats.
Tracy's cat started making a noise.
right then and there. And we have a visitation going on here.
Cat just wanted me to show Spock and Isis.
Oh, okay. Is camera. That all?
Yeah, that's, just wanted that's me to show Spock holding
that's what
Isis.
We needed right now.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that what I find refreshing about the idea of an adult novel that sort of speaks with a child's heart is, I mean, I'm coming up pretty fast here on 46 years old, which, wow, feels a certain kind of, hi guys, can we not do this now? There's going to be no way to edit this out, really.
No, so we're just keep gonna going.
Preserve the cat violence for forever.
I just wish people could see the cat whiskers on the screen that are happening, like, as the cats are being
closer. There's like actual fur flying.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
it's a 3D experience. I think for me, I don't know. I teach in a high school environment. And so while the people I teach are children, they are on the older edge of childhood with a lot of kind of confused expectations. A lot of the high school world is this kind of like, yes, you are minor children and therefore we're in charge, but we very much expect adult things of you. And we're kind of asking these kids to occupy two worlds simultaneously, to accept the absence of authority that is childhood at the same time as they're supposed to be like in charge of their lives in an adult kind of way. And it doesn't sync up very well. And I think that something like this book, which invites me to think like an adult, like Anatole does, with my particular like worries and concerns, but to look at the needs of a kid who has her own passions and her own desires that are being sort of overwritten by what the kingdom expects of her and what her father expects of her, feels very familiar to me. It's a story that sort of speaks to me on the level of sometimes I feel like I'm looking at my students as I see them getting plowed under by their parents' expectations and so on. And I think to myself, like, wow, here's an Anatole moment, isn't it? As I kind of reassess that. Yeah. Okay. Trying to do a cat management thing here. Okay. I've got one on the ground and one is up on the table right next to the mic here, right? And it's kind of a standoff. So I'm expecting a tumbleweed to roll between them at any moment. And good, the bad, and the ugly sort of music. It's going to be great. Not exactly the vibe that we were going for here. I have a completely unrelated train of thought. One of the words that comes up a lot in describing your work, Lewis, is weird. And I'm kind of curious what your relationship is to weird. I know everybody uses the word to mean different things, but I love talking to people who have a certain amount of weird in their bone structure as creators and talking to them about weird. So what are your feelings about weird? Does it just show up without intending it, or do you aim for weird?
Well, let me go back a long ways now. When I was in college, I am thinking I wanted to be a writer. I was reading a lot of absurd literature, like especially the plays of Ionesco.
Sure.
And my short stories that I wrote were kind of in that vein, just sort of these absurd stories. And then I had helped out at an elementary school nearby, just loved being around the kids, and thought I'd try writing stories for kids. And so what was absurdism when I was writing for adults just became childhood funny stories. And so that's what I was doing with Wayside School, with Sideways Stories from Wayside School. And I guess I've just always kept that same sense of humor. So I consider my books more absurd than weird, if that makes sense.
I think that's fair.
I think, you know, when people use weird to describe like Sideways Stories, the book wouldn't have held up this long if it was just weird.
Sure.
It's what makes the book, you know, last, what's given is that there's a lot of heart in it too. And there's a lot of, you know, Wayside School is just a very welcoming place to the kids who go there and to the readers. Mm-hmm. And I try to put that in, you know, again, in all my books. And in The Magician of Tiger Castle, with all the rewrites I did, I spent close to 4 years writing the book. And I mean, by the end, Anatole was like family to me, along with Pito and Tulia. I mean, I hope the reader feels that same connection with them that I felt.
Sure.
It's impossible for anyone you know that well to seem weird.
Yeah.
You've come to understand what makes them tick in a way that, I mean, what is weird but an effort to somehow say, there's something that I think of as normative and this isn't that. it's just some effort to say, like, here's this part of the bell curve that says this is what should be done or what people should be like, and somehow we're somewhere else. You know,
and I think there's a certain logic to my illogic. I mean, it all fits together in that world logically. It's just that the world itself is illogical.
Right. I mean, like, if you've got a school that's built so that every single story is its own classroom, then how does that create its own kind of logic of the school itself? You know,
right.
That is, if you create the conditions of a world where something makes sense within that world, it may seem strange in comparison to what we know, but it doesn't make it weird. It's the new normal. It's the different normal.
Yeah. Just like Anatole's world mm-hmm. where magic and science are kind of the same thing. So he's not limited by what we now know is what we think is possible and not possible.
Right, right. So, okay. I think this, for me, this is kind of the, this is the million-dollar question of writing fantasy. There's like a billion different kinds of fantasy out there, right? You can do the George R. R. Martin thing where it's just blood-soaked politics and womanizing and such, you know, up and down. Yeah, you've got your big sort of epic Lord of the Rings level moves. You've got your urban fantasies and your paranormals and your, you know, here's Twilight with sparkle vampires and just, you know, Harry Potter and the school story. You've got every kind of which way to Sunday, right? So I'm really curious about, you know, we're calling this a fantasy novel because this is a kingdom that doesn't really exist. That you've kind of just like gently wedged into the world of the 16th century. But I'm kind of wondering for you, what's the source of the fantasy? Like
I didn't think of it. I didn't think, oh, I'm writing a fantasy novel now. I just thought I was writing a story.
Yeah.
And then it has to be marketed some way.
Yeah, you got to put a label on it.
Yeah, so it's marketed as a fantasy novel. And, you know, I don't object to that. It is. But it's, to me, I'm just trying to write an engaging, fun story. Okay. And, yeah, I mean, I think I've already kind of described that I'm creating this world where there's a certain illogic to it, but it all fits. But once you accept the world that is as it is, it all makes sense.
I wouldn't have a lot of difficulty imagining Escueveta, the kingdom of your story here, as somewhere on the same map as Florin and Gilder and William Goldman's the Princess Bride.
Like, oh, it was very much inspired by the Princess Bride.
Oh, really? Okay. Mm. Yeah. That is, it's hard to go wrong with something that has that gives the sense of the Princess Bride to it. I think there's that is also a sort of.
And I did do a lot of research too. It's not just all made up in my head. I listened to the great courses and I listened to I listened to 36 lectures about life during the Middle Ages and another 48 lectures of life during the Renaissance.
Wow.
And so some of it is based on what I learned in those lectures, and it just sort of gave me a sense of the world of the 16th century. Although I picked and chewed, you know, I plucked some things from the maybe the 5th or 6th century and stuck them into the 6th, you know, 16th. But
anyone who decides to go through and fact check your book has clearly decided that they're on the wrong side of the reading process.
well, that's the advantage of having it in Escueveta. I said, well, that might be true for the rest of, you know, Europe, but for Escueveta, this is how
it's
different.
Yeah. It's its own logic, as you said. Yeah. So we now have the logic of our recording structure here, which means we're at Picks of the Week.
Producer's Log, Stardate 2025.09. We are heading into an area of empty space. Sensors indicate this has been caused by complicated personal schedules throughout the month of October, including but not limited to birthdays, speaking engagements, and an upcoming literary science fiction convention. Due to these conflicts, the episode going live in the feed on Tuesday, September 29th, will most likely be the last until October 27th. Patrons will, of course, still receive their exclusive patrons-only episode over on patreon.com/functionalnerds. Along with other exclusive content and perks, you should totally check it out. Why haven't you? I say most likely because the engineer, the audio engineer, is considering putting together some sort of highlight episodes of Patreon-exclusive podcasts to have something in the feed in October. But that bastard, he's insane. So who knows if he'll pull it off or simply sleep all the way through October. Looking ahead, the empty space clears and becomes crowded again into the usual breaks around the holidays. So we should be good for the last couple of months of 2025. In other news, I found out something really interesting about Dr. McCoy. Turns out he...
So Patrick, what is your pick for this week?
I'm on a piezo roll last few episodes. So there's one more that I wanted to there might be another one, but this one for sure I wanted to mention. Mm-hmm. So Paizo is the publishing company behind the Pathfinder and Starfinder TTRPGs. And they have launched on BackerKit. As of this recording, you still have like 30 days-ish to back it. Okay. Yeah. But they have launched a Pathfinder board game called Pathfinder Quest. And this is a board game for 1 to 4 players. It comes with a ton of minis. There's no game master that's needed. It's just a board game that you play. And it's got several different stories involved with it. So like you can play it and then you can replay it. You can continue the story if you want. They've got tons of extra stuff that you can get as stretch goals. Like they are they're releasing the I don't do the 3D printing thing, but other people do.
Sure. Yeah.
So they're releasing like the STL files, which I don't know what those are, but like
they sound fancy.
Those are the files that I guess you plug into your computer and then you can 3D print your own minis and that kind of stuff. Mm. So, tons of stuff. It's already funded. So if you wanted to back it, you can get it. If you want the deluxe edition of the game, you can only get it during this BackerKit thing. Mm-hmm. And then they've already hit a bunch of stretch goals and it looks like they might hit all of the stretch goals, which means you just get a bunch of extra stuff from them.
Cool.
So Pathfinder Quest is the name of the thing and it's on BackerKit and it's from Paizo.
So everybody needs to go back that so that Patrick can get lots of stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. The more people that back it, the more stuff
that's
what
I heard.
Yep.
All right. Lewis, how about you?
Well, I wasn't given advance notice of this.
Oh, dear.
So I played a game. I do like board games, and I played a board game last week. I'm just now trying to think, what was that called? I think it was called Galactic Cruise.
Okay.
Oh, okay. I think I've heard of it. Yeah.
It's it might not be exactly right. It might be sure. Galaxy Cruise or who knows. But it's something like that. And it's at first, I was kind of frustrated. They had this whole friend of mine has like 300 board games. Oh, yeah. And
sounds like Tracy.
Yeah. He has these, you know, once a year, big three-day weekends at his house where
sure.
everybody plays games. And so we play this game called Galactic Cruise. I was getting a little annoyed at first because it took like maybe an hour and 15 minutes to go through the rules. by someone who's played it before and he's just trying to teach the rest of the table. But once we got started, it was very much fun. We were all competing to we all worked for this Galactic Cruise line which took vacationers and onto space voyagers and we all were trying to move our way up the company.
I was looking it up as you were talking about it here. There's a website called BoardGameGeek.com that rates the different games. It's got an 8.4, which is a crazy high rating out of 10. Like that.
Yeah.
Usually anything above a 7 is worth checking out, but you get into the 8s and it's kind of into must play territory there. So that's a good get.
It's funny that you mentioned like the hour and a half to go through the instructions because my friends and I do that all the time. Like, I haven't played this game. I really want to play this game. I'm like, okay, let's get together. Let's play this game. So we sit down and play the game and they're literally like popping the pieces out as we're sitting down at the table because they haven't even done that yet. Uh-oh. And then they start kind of going through the instructions and about 10 minutes into that, I'm done and I stop listening. And I just wait for the game to start. And then once the game starts, that's when I start learning it. Like, yeah, that's how I do it.
It gets, right. It's easier when you're actually doing the things.
Yes.
And these guys all have, or, you know, a lot of the people who come bring their own games, mm-hmm. and they have, you know, they don't use the cardboard pieces. Somehow they have these metal pieces.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and you can buy upgrades for something. Yeah, you can
buy upgrades. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And the other thing that kills me is when they start reading the instructions and then they don't understand the instructions. So then they go to YouTube and then they're playing a YouTube video for all of us. And I'm just like, no, I'm done. I'm not paying attention anymore. You have lost me as your audience, sir.
Well, no, but this guy knew the rules. He was just taking us through it step by step. And
very thorough. Yeah. We almost every Saturday, not quite, but almost every, we have folks over here at Shea Townsend for gaming purposes. And it's become a pattern because of exactly this type of thing that you're describing, where the way I'm being attacked by the cat again, where the way that we manage that is they kind of try to agree in advance on like, what's the major game that we're going to play, like the one that will take, you know, more hours than the others. And so if we decide we want to play something after that, we might throw in a quickie after that point. So anyway, the play has become to find, like you were talking about, Patrick, a playthrough video it has to be 15 minutes or less. Otherwise people check out.
Yep.
You find a playthrough video online, you text it to everybody in the group and you're like, this is your homework. Watch the video before you come over. And so that way we can have it all like physically set up and whatnot. And wouldn't you know, half the time people are like, video. Like, come on, you have one job. I'm making dinner. We're giving you the house here, the whole thing. Watch the video. Just a few minutes. Alas.
Obviously, you can tell we are passionate about board games. We do love games. We love games.
We do. So that's an excellent pick for our folks around here. On the subject of alas, it's been a joke for so long that it's become something of a meme. I don't know how many dozens and dozens of times I've said I'm bad at television, but the listeners know that I'm very bad at television in the sense that anytime something takes off and becomes a phenomenon, I can be guaranteed to finally watch it like 2 to 3 years later. I was last one off that ship.
You are to television what I am to video games.
Kind of, yeah. By our powers combined, we know nothing.
For 2 to 3 years. And then I buy the Game of the Year edition that has all the downloads because I'm not messing with that crap.
It works. I mean, yeah. It's a strategy. That at least has an upside. Mine just means that I have to spend 2 to 3 years trying to avoid spoilers, which is just inconvenient. So anyway, in the midst of we are recording this on the 20th of September, which means we are only a couple of days removed from Jimmy Kimmel being sort of
silence.
Put on ice from ABC and the connections that has to Disney and so on. Wouldn't you know that I am currently planning a course to teach in January that's about fascism and Andor, the Star Wars series, which means I'm finally giving Andor a thorough watch right at the time that I feel an ethical push to probably cancel my Disney Plus subscription in the name of free speech. So,
which I did. And that's what's funny. I actually did cancel mine. And
you did. And here I am. here I am paying the man on a monthly basis because I need to prep a course about anti-fascism where I would probably just yell at Disney for 7 days with these poor students. But all this is building to, I am finally watching Andor. I'm halfway through season one. It is very true. If anyone else has not yet picked it up, it's a slow start. The first two episodes, you're going to be wondering, why am I here? And why does any of this matter? And then after that, we're off to the races. So if you are willing to give the series that first two episodes of patience, it really does have some intelligent things to say about what the use of power does to both the people who use it and to the people who are subject to it and how we respond to it and the ethical implications of those responses and all of that good stuff. So if you're looking for Star Wars with some brains, maybe you can find a Blu-ray set of it. Check out your local library. A lot of libraries still do like Blu-ray and DVD collections. Maybe they got it.
And if you, Tracy, get to season two, and you get towards the end, I may actually force you to watch a couple episodes of Rebels.
I'm going to need to watch the whole thing because, again, co-teaching a course on it. Yeah. So kind
of. So when you get to the end of season two, I'm totally gonna
is this a high school course?
Yeah. So I teach at a public boarding school for gifted students in Illinois. And in January, in between the fall and the spring semesters, we do this thing called intercession. And intercession lasts 2 weeks. And during that time, students enroll in courses that have a certain amount of academic rigor to them, but are very much not something you would normally have an entire course on. So for a week in January, I'm going to be teaching a 3-hour-a-day course on Andor fascism and the history of the anti-fascist movements. And so I'm co-teaching it with a history teacher, and we're going to be linking it to the White Rose movement in Germany that preceded World War II and the rise of the Nazis. We're going to be linking it to the Dutch resistance movement around World War II. We're going to be looking at the process of planning some of the extermination campaigns that the Nazis went into and likening that to a massacre that we see planned in Andor as well on behalf of the Empire and so on. And so we're going to be sort of, we actually almost every year, this history teacher and I have worked together to take something from the world of popular media and culture, usually a very nerdy thing, and link it to historical, philosophical, aesthetic stuff.
So your students are going to have to all get Disney Plus.
Or maybe they, we have in the prerequisites that students are encouraged to watch the program, but we can get by if they don't, because there's a couple of key episodes we were going to show in class. And we'll probably just hunt down a Blu-ray by that point. Mm. Yeah.
Well, so it sounds like a great class. Yeah. If I was in high school, I'd take it.
Certainly hope that it will be worth everybody's time. This has been very worth my time anyway, and Patrick's time. And I hope and you mine. Feel it's been worth your, well, wonderful. So folks, if Lewis, if folks want to get a copy of The Magician, the Magician of Tiger Castle, which we certainly hope that they do. Where should they go? What should they do to find you and support your cool stuff?
Oh, just wherever you buy books, whether it's wherever online or you know, I like supporting independent bookstores, but I'm not fanatical about it. Wherever you buy your books.
Yep.
Yeah.
Get you books wherever they come from. Well, thank you so much. It's been awesome having you.
It's been great. Thanks.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of The Functional Nerds. We really appreciate it. If you liked this episode, or really any of our episodes, please consider backing us over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can get access to some cool stuff and help us to keep the lights on. You can also show your support by mentioning us and sharing any of our episodes on your own social channels to help boost the signal. Trust me, that can be huge.
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry. Do you know who I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.